One of them is mine and one of them is yours. Actually, they're both ours, collectively. And the problems are that it's progressively become clear to all of us that when you do a project which actually is involved with the real world, it's messy, it's hard to schedule things, it's hard to get meetings with customers and stakeholders. Unlike a project you were doing on your own in the corner, which had no, like if you're like soldering or something, it's just you get it done and it's done, right? So people come to me and say, I need more time. And the answer, of course, you should take more time because there's no point in doing less on the project you want to do because the schedule has made some arbitrary date pop up. So while I pushed the schedule out on some of the deliverables already, I want to do it again because I don't want people to feel so stressed they can't do anything meaningful on their projects. So we normally had the ethnography work that was due this week. Some of you are still doing it. That's a good thing. You're still learning stuff from your customers. Some of you had meetings yesterday even. Today, some of you having meetings. The requirements, systemization, prioritization, and use case writing was going to be done next 11th. Most of you haven't even thought about that yet because you haven't had the ethnography finished enough to even know what you want to try to systematize. We were going to do blueprints after that, due on the 18th of November, to take sort of one particularly important service encounter and try to design it carefully enough to understand the architecture of front stage, backstage services, tangible evidence, all those kind of good things. We haven't got there yet, even though we already talked about that, because again, I thought we'd be farther along in the projects. Your last activity in the project was going to be to write a prototyping plan and then do some limited prototyping, just as you did some limiting ethnography given an ethnography plan. We had a final presentation schedule and a final report scheduled. I also think it's really important at some point to have a kind of take-home, I want to say conceptual checkpoint, because I don't want to say exam because that sounds too scary. That's not the intent. To give you a couple of questions to think about, choose some set of 4 out of 6 or something, to write some short answers about, to test your conceptual understanding of some of the key things in this class that you have to have your head around, that it's hard to assess in the context of a team project. I wanted you to do something individually at this point. And I originally said, let's do that before Thanksgiving so you can go home on Thanksgiving and have a week off. But I kind of want to just push everything, the first 3 out a week, and say, take till next week for ethnography, do requirements week after that, do blueprints week after that, which now we run up against Thanksgiving and haven't done the take-home thing yet. So I kind of want to say take the take-home thing like Thanksgiving plus a couple extra days after that. So we'd have like a week there to do this little take-home thing. Prototyping was going to start around Thanksgiving and go till about the 7th. We're running out of time at that point. Okay? So again, I want to do as much as we can do, but I don't want to arbitrarily stop you from in the middle of your project. And so I want to sort of ask the question about whether we could say, if you're going to be around another few days, maybe in December, to sort of push off, instead of this being the Wednesday of the second week of December, to push it off a couple of days, maybe even do it the following Monday or Tuesday, and then push things off a few days so you have more time to do some of this stuff. I can even imagine pushing this off even a little farther, 19th. Something like that. Again, the biggest problem is that at some point the university says, you must assign grades. And to me, that's the stupidest last thing I care about, grades. I care about having you have some meaningful experience in these projects. And so, think about how flexible you might be in mid-December. And if you could be flexible enough, we could push things out a week or so and everyone might have more fun on this project. Because I know some of you are really getting going finally and it's sort of, it would be unfortunate to say stop just as you're getting going. So think about that and see if there's some flexibility there. And I'm going to want to remind you that, I told you, as I told you on Monday, when I talked about this class at the service conference in Hawaii, everyone I talked to said, sounds like you guys are doing completely unique stuff on the whole planet. No one is teaching design this way of service systems. And IBM, Jim Spohr, who, we know he's kind of a big salesman kind of guy for the whole IBM service science experience, said, we should organize a global student teleconference symposium, for you guys in January sometime. It's like, Okay, calm down, Jim. But I like the idea that he's that enthusiastic about your project, that he sees that as a good thing. And he said, if you could take your 9 project reports and put them in a notebook for me, I'll send it all around IBM company. We'll find people that want to work with your students. And it's like, wow. So, you know, I'd hate to have things sort of just fall off at the end of the cliff on December 5th because you ran out of time. So again, a few extra weeks might actually make things a lot better to wrap things up and have more meaningful experiences for everybody. So we'd have to kind of bend the university rules a little bit. Sorry. I didn't say anything about bending university rules. That was just an ad lib. But we'd have to kind of push things around a little bit, but we might maybe make that work, and it would be probably a better experience for all of you. So like I could give people like temporary grades or incomplete grades for 2 or 3 weeks and let you have until like, you know, things like that. We can find ways to make the university go off our backs so you actually can do your projects if I had to. That's the first thing. Second thing is, you know, there are days I wake up and I said, this is the coolest class I'd ever imagined teaching because it really has got all these interesting, trying to bring in methods and techniques from different kinds of disciplines, end to end, not just front end, back end, but all this really interesting synthetic stuff I'm doing here. Then there it is, I said, this is too ambitious, and I'm basically being shallow about everything. And I particularly felt that way this week writing lectures on process modeling, because I could teach a course on process modeling. And I think it would be really important to be able to do that at some point, but I'm feeling that I'm doing 2 lectures where there should be 10 or something like that. And I wonder if you're feeling like, is it too shallow? Are you getting enough sense of what these techniques are about and how they fit together? Or am I we just skating so fast that it's like, boom, and it's gone and what the hell? And I'd rather stop and do things more in more depth if you're feeling that it's just sort of going by too fast and you're not really learning anything. Because I don't want to just expose you. I want to give you at least some stub of a skill so you can build on it in a future course or a future work. On the other hand, I'm trying to teach 5 courses and I know that. So maybe I can't have it both ways. So think about that too. So I rewrote this lecture you're going to get now 4 times in the last 3 days because I've tried to put 3 or 4 lectures into 1 lecture and I just don't think it's there yet. But trying to teach what I view as the minimal stuff, the kind of the most important ideas that you can build on. And this lecture is like, you know, 25 years of experience trying to be in 30 slides and I'm not sure it works. But again, I'm going to try. Because I think it's important, this vision of this course I think is really a good one that says you can teach the sort of framework course for design of a system rather than just a narrow slice of it. But on a bad day, I feel like I'm being shallow. So, I mean, I want you to think hard about that and tell what you really think. Not necessarily in public, but in the privacy of my office or in the privacy of an anonymous email or something, tell what you really think. Because I mean, I want to make sure that you're getting something out of this, and there are times I feel like I'm going so fast. I'm teaching 5 courses in 1 course, no question about that. So, if it's working, that's great. If it's not working, maybe we can fix it in the weeks we have left. So, again, we talked on Monday about process modeling on the experiential side, about the blueprint side, where we had a lot of person-to-person kind of service encounters to talk about. Today I'm going to move more toward the other end of that continuum of information-intensive service systems. I'm going to continue a little bit on that idea that I left you with yesterday about the levels of abstraction challenge, which is one of the key design problems when you're modeling processes. And I'm going to spend most of the time talking about a particular process metamod, one of those 3-level framework that I have actually found very useful. I should help develop it as part of the EBXML standards effort. That I think really works for this kind of information-intensive domain. But so I want to talk a lot about that and show you a lot of examples of process modeling with that kind of character. And then I'm going to close with some talk about transaction patterns, which I'm sure I'm not going to get to today. But I'll leave you with the stub of that as well. So if you remember where I left you on Monday, we were talking about how there's this inherent gap that emerges when you think about processes between high-level, kind of top-down view that at the strategic or executive level of a firm that says, what are we trying to accomplish at the goal kind of perspective, and the kind of bottom-up implementation transactional view which naturally emerges when you talk to people doing stuff with particular implementations. And you always have to have describe things at the level that makes sense to people who give you the description. So executives can't give it the bottom and the workers can't give it the top level of the description. But that means you may have multiple levels of description, and the question is, how do they fit together? So I'm going to give you a couple more examples, a couple more ideas around that to give you a little bit more stuff to stand on. And first, I ask you to read a short number of pages from Document Engineering Chapter 4 about information supply chains. And that was really this, give you the sense of almost sometimes another meta model, a minimum meta model for information intensive process model. So if you want to describe information intensive business, the minimal thing you'd want to do is answer these three questions. You'd say, which parties, service provider, service consumer, service customers, whatever the actor is, which ones are interacting with other ones? So who is talking to whom? Okay? And again, it's important to recognize that the same actor can have both producer and consumer roles. In fact, that's what a supply chain is, where you produce from one and you consume from the next, in some sense. And so, who's talking to whom? Question one. Second question is, well, what are they talking about? Now, what information are they exchanging when they interact, when they do a transaction, when they carry out services for each other? So what are they talking about? And finally, how often are they talking? So those three questions, who's talking, what are they talking about, and how often they're talking, is the minimal model of an information system. Very abstract, but very powerful when you reduce it to that simple, elegant meta model. So if some of you are having trouble with sort of describing things in information terms, just say, well, who is talking, what are they talking about, and how often? And that really gets at the essential part of the model, I think. And you can, of course, use that because it's an abstraction, it doesn't have any technology in it. You could ask the farmers these things, or the bankers, or the doctors. Who are you talking to? What are you talking about? And it really can get at this essential, it's often a good way to place to start an interview because it seems so obvious that it's not, you know, but it's the essential aspect of the model. Let me get another way to think about this. We talked about pizza yesterday, pizza on Monday. Remember we had the pizza recipe? Well, of course, that wasn't a very good recipe because it mixed levels of detail. And, of course, a good pizza recipe would have a description of the ingredients and the processes, namely how to prepare and cook for creating some kind of dish. And most recipes are written fairly narrowly, fairly precisely to produce a specific dish. This is the recipe for pepperoni pizza. Okay? But you want to ask yourself sort of more abstract questions and sort of see how there could be different levels of pizza recipes for different kinds of purposes. So what kind of, if I wanted to train the new employees at Pizza Hut to make pizza, what kind of recipe would I want to have? It'd be a very standard recipe. Would it have lots of detail or little detail? Lots of detail. Would it have very concrete instructions, you know, or very general instructions? Would it leave a lot of room for improvisation? No, it'd be very, very, do this, do this, do this, do this, do this. It might, in fact, say things like, make sure the lights are bright enough so you can read. You know, it might have a lot of that kind of, presumably extraneous detail, but because you make sure the context is right for a new employee. All these things, you know, make sure your hands are clean. I mean, things that you would take for granted if you were a cook, but if you're training an employee, you'd have lots and lots of detail. Okay? But suppose I was in, say, the Pizza Hut experimental kitchen, you know, when I'm trying to invent new pizzas, okay, in the main office. What kind of pizza-making recipe would I have that helps me understand differences between pizzas and perhaps invent new ones? It would be a different recipe, right? It would have talk about pizzas in a different way. It might be one or two levels up in that abstraction hierarchy, saying, what kind of interesting new vegetables could we use in our pizza? What kind of interesting new fruits should we put on pizza? We have a pineapple pizza, you know? Do we want to have a soybean pizza? You want to have, an apple pizza, right? Again, you'd have to be at a different level of description. And finally, what kind of pizza-making recipe would help me figure out what do pizza and making pizza have in common? So I can invent something like focaccia. It'd be even higher up. It would say, you need some kind of dough, and doughs have the following kind of property. Here's the continuum of dough kind of recipes. So it'd be, again, a very different kind of recipe, So it's still a pizza making recipe, but it would have very different kinds of terms and processes in it. And so it's again this abstraction gap in process models is really critical. You've got to have some level of description that's appropriate for the task you have. And you may have to have multiple levels of description. So to go back to where we started, the two most easiest ones to get are always the high-level strategic goal-oriented one. We want to make pizza. And then the one that says, here's how we do it in this particular kitchen with the particular set of pots and pans and so on, and this particular model of oven and so on. And what's in the middle there is the big challenge that we've been trying to meet for a long time in process modeling. So this effort called EBXML, Electronic Business XML, which was started about 2001, to merge XML business standards and EDI business standards, if that means something to you, that's great. If not, I'm not going to tell you what it means. Try to think very hard about how to describe business processes, and they came up with a three-layer model that has components of the process, and the process consists of one or more collaborations, and collaborations consist of one or more transactions. And I'm going to talk about these in detail. And again, these are the terms used in EBXML. Other people use words like process, subprocess, activity, task. And there are different words for these intermediate layers. But this idea that there needs to be a middle layer of description which is more abstract than the information exchange or transaction layer, but more refined than the goal layer, okay, is the key idea here. Yes. Yes, that's the next 10 or 20 slides. I'm going to go through this in detail because this is too abstract. I'm going to have to go. I always start with the abstraction when you do it down. You know that by now. Right? So, process consists of collaboration, which consists of transactions. But let's talk about what transactions are, and you'll see. So again, transactions are the easiest to see always because that's what people are doing and machines are doing. Machines are sending messages to each other. People are doing work with each other. It's like the atomic unit of work in some service relationship or commercial relationship. And you often have roles. You have a requesting role and a responding role, or a provider and a consumer, okay, where in some sense, if you have an information-intensive environment, what you have is someone is sending a message or a document to request something, and then there is or to do something, and then there may be a second document in the opposite direction that is either the response or an acknowledgement or something like that. So it's either a one- or two-way exchange, but there's always this notion of the two parties. And in fact, we almost always model transactions as two-party exchanges, even if they may be multiple. Even if it's many-to-many, we often view that as a set of two-party exchanges because it's easier to do that way. So, for example, if the simplest commercial transaction is, here's my order, or here's my offer, and you have an acceptance, right? So there's I suggest the price, and you say, I'll take it, that kind of thing. Offer and acceptance, right? A bid and an acknowledgement. What's an auction? An auction, you could say, well, there's a lot of people doing all this stuff at once. I said, no, an auction is a choreographed set of two-party exchanges where you're making an offer to the seller who owns the goods. There may be a bunch of doing the same thing at the same time, but there's some rule by which you decide who gets to win. So it's really modeled as binary offers. But the auction is kind of a process wrapper around that binary offer. So we often depict this kind of transaction, again, as exchanges in, say, a sequence diagram between the different actors. So here you see, when we were building a calendar system, we have an event submitter wants to submit a possible entry to the calendar by sending a message to the calendar administrator, who then sends back perhaps an acknowledgement. Okay, that local administrator then maybe they want to send it in another transaction for that to a central calendar for syndication, let's say. And again, it comes back and so on. So you see, these are modeled as pairwise transactions, and the complete process is modeled as some set of them. Now, this differs, of course, from a service blueprint pretty significantly. What are the key differences from this kind of description of a process and the one you saw on Monday with the blueprint? There's at least two big differences that are important. What point of view is the blueprint emphasizing? That's one of the key ones. Amy.
Well, I was going to say you don't see the line of visibility.
Right. This in some sense, instead of having a point of view with perhaps the default or normative customer or user as the point of view, and from that perspective you see various services which are more or less distanced from that point of view, so you have lines of visibility. This is kind of, I have to say, the God's eye view of the service, where you look at all of it at once from the top down, and all the actors are essentially viewed as equivalent in point of view. There is no, we could say, well, let's wrap it around from this person and show, but that would be a blueprint. This shows all of them at the same time. Really important difference. It also de-emphasizes the differences between human and computational actors. This kind of traditional UML sequence diagram kind of notation. We could also model the same kind of thing with a different thing called an activity diagram, which is another UML standard representation. This is different in that it shows, rather than the actors being kind of first-class citizens, it has essentially the process being the first-class citizen, and the actors themselves are somewhat hidden. In that it's it isn't quite clear exactly, you know, you have to sort of dig out the actors in this chart. In addition, this depiction always shows the exceptions or failure or unhappy conditions, right? We talked about the happy success model and the unhappy model, whatever it is, which is not as easy to see in the sequence diagram, because again, they're just some information exchange. This show really shows the branch where some decision is being made, and that decision isn't nearly as salient in this notation. All right. So, what is a business transaction? Transaction again is this binary exchange, and importantly, it has an outcome. It either succeeds or fails. When I send a message to somebody, I make an offer to somebody, I make some kind of intervention with the other party, I expose myself to the risk of having some obligation being created. If I make an offer to you and you accept it, we have a deal. Right? So in some sense, this is one of possible transaction semantics. There's actually a number of different transaction patterns. Not all of them have this, but business transactions, the commercial type, have the property that if I make an offer to you and you accept it, we have a deal. So we have a legally binding obligation. And that sort of obligation semantics is really important, because it means that if we decide to break that deal, it requires an additional transaction. So you can't kind of just roll back and say, well, pretend we didn't do that, because you've actually changed the state of the world. You've created an obligation. And we typically think in terms of a compensation transaction. So it's like if I say, I made this order, and I ordered a car, or I tried to buy a house, and I decided I want to back out of the deal, I may have to pay a penalty of some kind, or otherwise compensate the other party for breaking the contract that we set. Okay? And that can play out over a long period of time. So, you know, a business transaction may last weeks, months, or years while I'm doing some kind of business process of that scale. We have this notion of a long-running transaction to describe this thing, to contrast with something which is not really a transaction in this sense at all, but we use the same word, which is a database kind of transaction. I want to make sure just to point that this is not what we're talking about. In databases, we talk about a group of statements that basically act on an all-or-none basis to change the state of some information resource. Again, as a simple model of success or fail, it either succeeds or it fails. But if it fails, it's as if it never happened. So unlike a sort of business or service transaction where we do some service and things are now different, we create change in the world, in a database transaction, if it's failed, it just never existed, because we can roll back things to the state before the transaction happened. And that's partly because it can happen in a very short period of time, so it's like as if we could make the world stop during the period of that transaction. So I don't care much about this sort of thing. This is not the level. This is a level 3 description of business. We don't care about that really so much. But I want to make sure that you don't confuse those two words, even though they have the same word. Transaction and transaction are homonyms. Database transaction and service transactions of kind of the commercial type are very different animals. Now, when I design transactions or try to describe transactions, I use you can use any kinds of artifacts, but you can draw a diagram, you can create an XML instance of some business process, a transaction specification. I like to do a worksheet, and I'll show you what that means in a minute, because it lets you capture parts of the model as you discover them. It's a lot less prescriptive way of doing it than if you say, I need to draw a diagram as the first artifact. So typically, I go into an interview when I'm trying to understand, or an observation, I'm trying to understand some business activity with a template of sorts. You saw these in my book, where I have a mental model that says, I want to describe some business activity, I'm going to give it a name and a description, and I'm going to see who basically is involved in it, and some of the information about preconditions and postconditions and exceptions and so on. And this I may develop this through a number of different observations, a number of different interviews. I'm not going to get it in some particular order. You'll learn from people what they know. So you may talk to the person who's on the receiving end of a transaction. They'll say, I get this for the following reasons. This is what I do with it. Versus the person who initiates saying, well, I sent it to this person because of this. I don't know what they do with it. So the sort of more kind of friendlier meta model for collecting the information about the transaction is a good thing. And that's why I recommend you do it when you're trying to observe some activity, having a sort of a neutral mental model like this, where you're like filling out a form in any order, helps you develop this kind of understanding of the situation in a way which doesn't require it to happen in some particular order. You can't say, no, I don't want to hear about that yet. You know, they'll just tell you what they're going to tell you in an interview, for example. So this gives you a sense of what you know and what you don't know as you're interviewing people and as you're observing things. Now let's talk about collaborations. So collaborations are essentially groups of transactions which kind of fit together to carry out some larger purpose. And they have more in common with each other than with other parts of the business process. So again, it's like you have 10 transactions take place to carry out some business process. To run a supply chain, run an auction, run a course registration, whatever the thing you're trying to describe is. And some of them go together. Now again, go together is a kind of a fuzzy word, but go together means they have some necessary and meaningful semantic overlap, meaning that they have some parties and actors in common, and there may be some necessary overlap because maybe one transaction creates information that's needed by the second transaction, and so on. It's like, is there a need-to-know basis between the different actors who are working together in this collaboration? And again, that's often there may be more than one way to organize things, but it will shape how you go about building things when you have essentially put these higher order concepts on your transactions. So, for example, this is a model, again, from my book, showing you the drop shipping, where we have a retail site, like a retail bookstore site, and there are the book warehouse, and then there's the book delivery service. And here you see that first the bookstore wants to see if the book is available, and if it's available, then it will basically put the book in its catalog. And then the bookstore can make an order for that book, and that will cause the book to be shipped for the delivery service, and then ultimately the bookstore can ask later on, was the book delivered? But so I have here a requesting the service, a contract formation, and a delivery, distribution and fulfillment collaboration, which are these three distinct phases of this overall process, and they're separated because, well, for example, the book's distributor doesn't need to know how the book got into the catalog. So this is clearly a separate set of transactions and stuff up here. Likewise, the book distributor does need to know who gets the book. So they have to have some information coming to them from the order. So they have to have something to do here, has to get to their side. So those things, they group together that way. So this idea of how you carve up a process, a big fuzzy goal or anything like sell books, into these sets called collaborations is kind of important. Let me show you a couple of examples. I'm going to work out in pretty much detail now to make sure this is clear because it's fuzzy stuff. So how do you model a process with this three-level meta model? First, you say, who are the actors involved at the transactional level? When I go in there and observe things moving around, the services, who are the actors that are carrying those services out? Where they're interacting, and what are they exchanged with each other? That's the kind of, who is doing that kind of low-level stuff? Then you identify and name those relationships or services, those transactions. Then I can say, well, how do those transactions fit together? What is the decision logic that causes one transaction to cause the next one? So it's like, if I make an order and the order is accepted, then I better figure out some way to deliver the book. So that will connect the ordering from the delivery transaction. They'll have overlapping information. So I can then organize related sets of transactions and call them collaboration, give that collaboration a name. But it's not as deterministic as that. Here's a good example. This was a homework assignment when I taught 6 lectures on process modeling and document engineering 2 years ago, rather than 2. I gave a lot more assignments because we wanted people to learn this stuff. So I'm going to give you the summary of the assignment so you can see how it would have turned out if you had done it if you had another week to do process modeling. So here you see a narrative description of how you might go buy a used car. Please read this, you know, quickly and sort of get a sense of the overall process. Again, I described it this way so people all have the same process description to start with. People are now reading the process description. Process of buying a used car. Hang on. Now, first of all, don't be confused by my bullets. The bullets are there for visual clarity. They have nothing to do with what things might go together or not go together. I just put them there because I wanted to separate this big blob of text. Now, it might be, but there's no necessary relationship between bullets and any other modeling construct here. So you basically have the idea what I'm... This strikes me as a pretty reasonable description of what it would be going about to buy a used car. So I say, well, who are the actors? Who are the actors in this model?
A person buying the car.
A buyer?
Salesperson.
A seller?
The car.
Car's not an actor.
DMV.
The DMV is an actor.
Okay.
The insurance vendor. Okay. The person who's selling you the insurance. The mechanic could be. There could be additional information sources besides people. Like maybe the Kelley Blue Book or something like that, which would be a resource that tells you what the average price of a used car is of a certain kind of condition. That could be an actor. Okay?
Well, why wouldn't the car be an actor if Kelley Blue Book is? If you could go and look under the hood and get all sorts of...
The car is an object that's being acted upon, so you trust the sources, like a mechanic is going to look at your car, perhaps. You look at the car, but that's not part of the transaction that's going to be invoked, perhaps. You could say, ask questions of the car.
Well, I think that is, you evaluate if it's the right one that you want to buy.
Well, okay, so see, we're having trouble even at the transactional level here. You look at the VID, you could say, investigate the VID from the car so you know which car it is. So again, this looks like a pretty straightforward description. We're already discussing it, as if there was, that's not clear. Okay, where do you get the driver's license from? The DMV, right? Where do you get the smog certification from? The mechanic? Possibly. It says you get the smog from your mechanic. I guess it says it's from your mechanic. So it's the same guy, I guess, right? Not says it could not necessarily be, but I guess I made it the same guy. Damn it. I could have said from a mechanic. It could have been then two mechanics, right? Not the same guy that you could get evaluated. It could be different people. So, you identify these transactions. You say, now how am I going to organize them into collaborations and their sequence? So, here is one. You really can't read this. It's not intended to be perfectly read, but it says here, and again, the person laid this thing out as buyer down the left, information source, mechanic, seller, DMV, insurance. And they're trying to write a set of transactions showing which pairs are involved in which information exchange. They failed to give me any collaborations. There's no higher order organization here that gives you sort of like phases of this model. So that's not a very good model. This person says, oh, I got this thing figured out. There's purchasing and then there's registration. So purchasing involves, you know, figuring out which car I want to buy and then asking the buyer, seller about a price and then comparing this quote to the information source and the mechanic, check the vehicle quality here. You purchase the vehicle, you transfer the title. Here you get your smog certificate, you tell the DMV you have the smog certificate, you get your quote, you buy the insurance. Reasonable? Well, but we've buried a lot of detail here. I mean, if you remember the model that we described in the narrative form, we said you negotiate. Negotiate may, in fact, involve way more than just one offer. There may be a series of offers that have to go around the block a few times. And so it's possible that this could have been modeled in much more detail as a set of offers and acceptances, because maybe negotiation is really a collaboration in its own right, a higher order construct in this model. You may, in fact, want to bring in a third party to help you negotiate. Let me bring my lawyer in here. Okay? Yeah, two collaborations, purchase and register. Does that seem right to you? Are there other ways you could have thought about this activity? Annette?
It's kind of arbitrary. Transferring the title could be under registering as easily as under purchasing.
Could be, couldn't it? In fact, transfer title means the seller signs over the pink slip. Okay? Now, of course, this could be the first step in registration. In fact, the registration says, first, make sure you have a signed pink slip. So it's probably written as a prerequisite to this, the registration process. Where's the lines drawn? Well, this person, who you really can't read, says there's finding a car is the first collaboration, followed by buying a car, followed by registering stuff. Okay? That to me seems actually a better organization of these transactions, because finding a car, you know, you could be doing a lot of research that doesn't involve any particular seller at all. Before you even get to this, I'm going to do a lot of research, check these different information sources. What should a good price be? What should a good condition be for this car? Then you go talk to the seller. With that information in hand, it could be a separate phase of this thing. And finally, here's another model which has another problem, in that unlike the first model which had no collaborations, this one has almost as many collaborations as transactions. Which means that the abstraction gap between collaboration and transaction is very small. There's not much of a benefit of having organizations if you have one thing in every bin. Right? But this model has an interesting insight, which is that it has this actor that you can't read, but that actor says, car marketplace. Because if you remember the description, it says, you locate a car or a group of cars that is for sale, and then you select one as a candidate to purchase. Everybody else missed that and said, go find the seller and start the car process, buying the car process. This person said, well, where do I find cars? I go to the car marketplace, which is an aggregator of cars for sale. That's a service provider. It's an actor in this process model. So, four students, four different models. I could have shown you 24 of them that would have been all different to certain degrees. So, that was a simple model. This is page one of a three-page process description. I want you to read this. This is the process of course structure, something you all know too well at this campus. Start reading this one. We're now reading page one of the process of course registration. Just that's got a sense of what's in it. Here's the second one, second page. It's a pretty complicated process. You might not realize how complicated it is because you've done it now a lot of times, but a lot of conditions and constraints. And finally, the third page of this description. Now, this description is written in a slightly different way than the first one. The first one I wrote to be, in some sense, a revised description. I went and interviewed a number of people, made a number of observations about the buying a used car process, and then I tried to organize it in a way which was reasonably consistent and coherent and chronological. Okay? This model is written as if I went and interviewed someone and said, tell me how you register for class, and this person then gives you this kind of long, rambling interview, which is what your data is most likely to be like when you go do an interview. Okay? Where you have a small number of observations. But as a result, this is even a more difficult model to describe because you have to do some repair in some ways, which we'll talk about. So that's the three pages of this. The first time I gave this assignment, it was a disaster. Because students were so far apart, we could hardly compare what they did. Anyone have an idea why? What's the first thing I ask you to do when I say model in this three-level way? The first thing I say to do is what? Identify the actors at the transactional level. Okay? And in this this thing here, I say things like, the school says this, the university says this. And people said, oh, but in fact, you know what? The university is really 16 different offices, and the school is really professors and the dean and the clerks, and people modeled some of these things with 20 actors because they imagined at their interaction they went to one office to get this form and one office to get this form, and they had a very low level, precise level 3-ish implementation level description of what went on, which is accurate in some ways, but it meant that their model was gigantic with lots of actors. So the next year, I said, let me make it easy for you. There are four actors. I'm going to take, you know, remember we talked about paying for the stuff and registering for stuff and classrooms, all that stuff, remember? I said, that's the university. That's one actor. Don't have separate classroom office and separate payments office and separate, you know, registrar. It's the university. That's a huge abstraction already. It's essential if you're going to design a system which is going to fix this mess to say, this should be a black box that hides all this crappy implementation detail the university throws on you. Nonetheless, again, the school hides a lot of things there. Who decides what courses are offered? Committees, professors, deans, make it to school. So again, we have this big kind of abstraction already just by picking the actors. And that's obvious in this when you compare it to the used car, how much more complicated this process is. So, how's it going to work out? What are some of the collaborations involved here? So if you look at the way I wrote this, I said, well, there's how do classes come to be, which is what this really is. How do students decide what they're going to take? And then how do they actually sign up for stuff? So it looks like there's three collaborations. And that's what many people did. So here you see, actually there's four collaborations. University, school, instructor, student, course catalog generation, classroom figuring out, getting the class schedule, and then requesting your enrollment. Sound about right? I don't know. How about same thing? Here you have teaching schedule negotiation, classroom negotiation, class selection enrollment. This is now a very big collaboration rather than two or three of them. Again, different granularity of this. And that may be the last one I'm showing you. The details of any of these models are not important. That's not why I'm showing these things. I'm showing this because modeling is hard. Yes?
Why student is the last column? Is student not the initiator?
Well, I mean, there's, you know, when you put the student where you put the student. Some people put the students at the end. I guess they all did, looks like. Nope, not quite. This one has the instructor in the first column. Again, we're not saying this is a student blueprint. We're saying it's a process model in which the actors are the actors. And we may actually arrange the columns in a way to make it look right for ourselves. There's no necessary way to have, you know, students have to be one or the other. It just happens that way. Well, but who's the initiator in this process? The instructors decide which courses to offer. So they viewed that the first one should be the instructor. Okay? So who decides which courses the instructors do? So again, it depends on what your scope of this process is. If you said students decide what course to take and assume the courses are already there, then maybe the student is initiating the process. But if you say courses have to happen somehow, then obviously, students are not the initiators of that process. So again, what's the scope of your model? Something we've heard about before, scoping your problem, right? Okay, so what have we seen here? We've seen that the same description or interview about a process, different analysts will do different things, and they'll agree, if at all, at the transactional level. They probably will not disagree very much, not agree very much, at higher levels, because they're going to organize it differently. Especially if they imply backstage actors or the aggregate actors in a different way than other people do. Like we have university could be five actors versus one actor. You know, car marketplace could exist or not exist in some models. So this should maybe not surprise you, but it should be make you sensitive to this issue. So, again, I haven't really explicitly asked you to do very much of this, but some of these issues come up even with the level of blueprint, which is a much more concrete, shallow kind of level of modeling. But if you're doing any kind of serious modeling of information-intensive systems, these kind of issues will be pretty important. Now let's talk for a few minutes about the DSM. And I hope that you took my advice and skimmed some of those nasty pages in there, because it did get pretty nasty. But the big ideas, I think, are really important here as a kind of conceptual rather than a technical reading. Now, this DSM is a relatively recent invention. It developed from people studying design processes and manufacturing methods. They were interested in how you could manage concurrency in design and manufacturing. And that's a good idea because it can significantly speed the process of design and development if you can manage it right. But managed badly, it can cause a lot of rework because you're doing things over that could have been done once rather than more than once. And so the design structure matrix is a notation for analyzing the flow of information and flow of control in a design problem. So you look at these, the iterations in that. So I'm arguing that you should have this in your head, not as the technical thing that is presented there, but as a kind of way of thinking about your models. So what you're really doing in DSM is analyzing the dependencies between activities. So let's look at the notation first. So we say the processes or activities or tasks are the rows and columns of a matrix. And each row will represent in each cell information about whether the processes in the row and column are dependent on each other in any way. So if process A and process B are parallel, then they're both dependent on each other in arbitrary order, or they're independent of each other in arbitrary order, so they have no X's in the intersections, because they can be done independently. If the processes are sequential, whereas A must precede B, then B will have an X there showing that A has to come first. If they can occur in a way which requires them to be iteratively handled, then they'll have X's in both cells, because this says A and B together form an iterative cluster. So A and B have to be done kind of in combination and iteration. So what you do in DSM is to take the task, once you've figured out what they are, and that's a modeling problem in its own right, to figure out what are the tasks that you're trying to identify the transactions, identify the activities. You then create this matrix which shows for the activities that you've identified whether activity A influences activity B and so on. So when you read across the column, it says what are the inputs to B. B has inputs from A, from G, and from J. And what does A influence? A influences B, C, D, I, and J, and so on. So this says what things affect each other. You know, feed information to, feed constraints to, feed design ideas into, and that will show you situations where information is essentially needed that you didn't have at the time you wanted to make the design decision. So it's bad to be above the line, to be above the diagonal, because above the diagonal means that you have feedback, necessary feedback, and necessary input from a later activity to an earlier one. That's bad. Because that means that you didn't have enough information to do it right. You've got to do something over. Consider new information. So we then analyze in this matrix sort of the good iterations from the bad iterations. So obviously, if these tasks here, E, F, G, H, and I, have this kind of mutual dependency, then they have to stay together in that block. That's going to be a big body of work that has to get done that way, and there's no way to fix it. But these things here reflect situations where something is in the wrong place. So the overall idea here is to essentially rearrange the matrix by redefining the tasks to sort of eliminate the X's that are above the diagonal, or to move them closer so there's less intervening activity that will require rework. So you can do this by first saying, what's the first task that has to get done that can't possibly have any prerequisites in my model? Put that in the first task. And then figure out which ones that follow it, what the relationship is, and try to minimize the coupling. So you end up with the smallest number of boxes and make the boxes as small as possible. That's the design goal from a conceptual standpoint. Now, it's done with fancy computers that take these matrices and they rearrange them and try to find optimal order, but you don't need to do that. You can do it slightly more, less formally. And instead of rearranging the task, you can rearrange the people So they give them different things to do at different times. So again, you can either rearrange the task or reorganize the people to try to separate some of these things. And in the end, you want to get a better design process. So here you see we might have optimized this process by rearranging some of the rows, taking some of the tasks which were getting in the way, like J, and moving them down, doing them later. Because this way they don't have to redo other things. But here you see there's some pretty essential things that have to get done as clusters. So this may in fact be a model that says how to organize your design team or your design organization. Now, we can apply this to things like course registration. So here is, in fact, course registration. So students in this, when they did their model, they also had to do a DSM version of their model and say, what are the tasks and what are the dependencies? Now, that story, again, had some pretty bad things in it, like task-work conflict. Remember the story, the last line of the story? It said, sometimes the student discovers that his work schedule for his part-time job conflicts with the course he wants to enroll in, or already has enrolled in, and this causes problems. Specifically, what does it cause problems? It says, I gotta drop that class and re-enroll in something else. So, checking your work schedule should be done before you register for classes. Duh. Right? But, in this case, when the student was doing the narrative, they probably were saying, yeah, once I had this problem where my work schedule got in the way and I had to drop classes. So, it might be how they told you, but it's clear that that's the wrong place for that task to be in the model. Got it? So, we rearrange that task and figure out where it should go to optimize the decision process. And sure enough, we're going to move that thing up to an earlier place. So instead of it being the last task, essentially check for work conflict, we're going to move it up a couple of rows and it's going to eliminate that problem. We're going to, and then identify some coupled activities. Namely, figuring out what courses are going to get offered, getting the schedule and classroom configuration right, and then registering for classes, planning and registering for classes. And of course, the last thing that happens is the course cancels, because that can happen any time. So you might as well hope it's last. And it was one that you didn't get. So we've essentially, these are all the ones, these are the student activities, scheduling, design of classes. So they naturally fall into three big bins now of collaborations of figuring out the schedule, figuring out the location and time, and then student picks the schedule. So we've cleaned up that narrative into these three collaborations by applying this DSM kind of approach in a very kind of informal way, but nonetheless, by knowing what to look for in a systematic way, we have a better model than if we had just tried to say, well, this looks right to me. So the idea of this DSM is a way, like lean consumption from the other day, we said, are all the things you're doing adding value for the customer? The lean consumption philosophy says, ruthlessly examine all the touch points and ask yourself, does the customer getting any benefit from this interaction? This is a more abstract way of looking at the same thing, saying, ruthlessly examine all the dependencies and eliminate all those which are unnecessary. So in fact, it may be the case, you say, you know what? We're always going to find feedback at some point. They could change the design decision, but let's make that into release 2. We'll make a point saying anything happening at this point will affect the next version rather than the current version. So we'll shrink this box by having an arbitrary cutoff for like the next release. So that's a way to manage this kind of dependency by saying we'll put a deadline condition in and say that if you learn it after this point, it's next release's feature. So does this kind of thing seem like you could apply it? I mean, again, there are pages and pages of probabilistic dependencies and stuff, and I said, forget that stuff. Because people run number crunches to figure these optimal matrices out, but as a heuristic way of looking at process modeling, does it make sense to you? Could you imagine using it? Yeah.
Seems like if you did this matrix first, it would make doing the other model so much easier.
And why is that?
Because then it organizes it in a logical manner before you get started on it.
Well, the question I was about to ask was, if you hadn't come up with that, was, well, where do collaborations come from? Right? What are collaborations have necessary and meaningful semantic overlap? Which means you have to have information to make the thing possible. Which means this kind of analysis would really help have a more systematic set of collaborations. Exactly the point I wanted you to get to. Thank you. So this as a you know, design checklist, checkpoint, you're saying, I have a sense of what I want to do in this process. I know what basically some of the key activities are, but is it the right order? And you say, does this step at this moment in time add value? Or is it going to get undone because something I'm going to learn later on? So that kind of, they're independent checks. The lean consumption is an independent check from this. And together I think they give us better marks. Well, that's about 5 years of insight for me to learn how to do that, because it's easy to go in and just describe what goes on and say, this looks okay. How can we fix it? How can we improve this model? And have that be kind of a qualitative, what would be better than what I have now? And so now I think in terms of design patterns and DSM and lean consumption as heuristics to help make sure that when you go from an as is to a to be, you're making a better model instead of just it feels better. And that's kind of important. All right. Well, I only have one thing to talk about now, and it's going to go pretty fast because I'm pretty tired. I know you want to get to work. It has to do with business transaction patterns. I want you to look at this conversation between A and B. A is a potential buyer, and B is a seller of, say, notebook computers. I want you to look at this and look at the interaction, and we'll see that while these are all information exchanges, transactions, they're not the same kind of transactions. And that's important because this will have a lot to do with the way in which your transactions glue together or don't glue together in a process model. So why don't we play this out? I'll be A and you be B, okay? So I'll say A and you just, so I say, where can I buy a notebook computer?
Here's my catalog of notebook computers.
That's good. I want to buy this one.
Okay. And here's your invoice.
Okay. When will the computer come?
By next Tuesday. Here's my complete catalog in case you're interested in other products.
Is that a plausible interaction? Plausible conversation? Okay. Let's look at what everybody went on there. When I walked up to the counter or to the retail side or whatever it was, when we first came up to see Amy, at moment one, do we have any relationship at all? Does she owe me anything? Does she have made any promises to me? Does she even know who I am? None of that. It's our sort of no obligation interaction. We're first having our first encounter. When I say, we're going to buy a set of a computer, she says, here's my catalog. Now, will she give that to anybody who asks that question? She probably will. She doesn't say, now maybe if she's really smart, she'll discriminate based on my clothes or something, but she'll say, here's my catalog. So it's probably the case that that's completely no strings attached, no personalization, no based on my identity kind of interaction. I then say, I'd like to order this one. And she says, okay, what's happened? All of a sudden,
you've made a contract based on.
I just bought a computer. She just promised to deliver it to me. So that okay, is her acceptance of my offer to buy. We have a contract. That's a commercial transaction that just took place. We have an obligation. Me to pay, her to deliver. And then she says, and here's your invoice. I say, okay, which is exactly what she said just before. Is my okay the same as her okay? Does it mean the same thing? Michael? That okay is not necessary. I'm acknowledging it, but there's no reason for me to have to acknowledge that. So my okay, the same message, means a different thing. Which means, when you're seeing messages moving around, you got to know where they fit into a process, because the same message may mean different things in different places. Ooh. What are they talking about when they're sending this information? We're talking about a different thing when I say okay the second time. When will the computer arrive? Now, that's a question I'm asking of the seller. So was question A. So was question one. Is it the same kind of question? When I asked question A, question one, and I said, I got a catalog, it didn't matter who I was at that point. She could answer that question, here's the standard catalog. When I asked question seven, she has to give a different answer to me based on who I am, based on our existing relationship, which was created in line four. Now, number nine. There is no line 10, right? Why is that?
Because it starts over.
It's starting over. I mean, in some sense, this is a kind of notice to the world that may or may not apply to me. It's just information. It's not tied to me at all or to our previous interactions. So what you've just seen, really simply, are transaction patterns that basically differ substantially in the semantics of that relationship. And I'm not going to go through these because you can read my book and you can read my slides just as much as I can. The bottom line is essentially this, that you choose the transaction pattern reflects sort of, is a response required? Notification repudiable? Can I deny I did that? Or is it, once I said it, we have an obligation? Does it tie to what I already have done? Are the residual obligations? That kind of stuff. So these are issues which do fine-grained distinctions between different kinds of transactions, and they're important when you want to build a more complex process to recognize that they plug together in certain ways and not in other ways. You can't plug in a transaction that assumes a previous relationship when there was not one. That's why we call it spam. Because you don't have a pre-existing relationship with those people. If you've already bought something, then it becomes notification to a previous customer. Very different, right? Okay. That's it. Talk about the next. Our next lecture is going to be about multi-channel context. One of the new contexts we've been hinting at but never talked about explicitly. We're going to talk about it for a whole hour and a half. There's three papers there. Too much reading. Let me give you some simplification. The most important paper is the paper by Neslin. It talks about five challenges in designing multi-channel service systems. Lots of great questions there about and pointed to all the research to answer some of those key questions, like the nature and the reciprocity between the channels. In the bookstore, the smart bookstore, what information from the physical store should be shared with the online bookstore and vice versa? That kind of stuff. The most provocative paper is one by Jeffrey Huang. It's written by an architecture professor who talks about the relationship between virtual space and physical space. And he writes about systems for... I think one of his examples is could you have a store which lets you try on virtual clothes clothes in a virtual online retail? And how that would relate to other contexts. It's a really provocative paper, fun to read, goes fast. Not as deep as the first one, but it's an interesting paper. Third paper is kind of a techniques paper. It's about designing service blueprints which connect the two channels. So if you have a physical world and an online world, how do you diagram that to show the connection between the worlds? Useful stuff. A little long, a little too researchy. So skim a lot of that one, and particularly skim the bank examples. Just look at the pictures. All right. So with that, I think I'm going to stop now and.